you know, I'm part of the tribe, the security tribe, and I really, really enjoy my tribe. And that's where I feel at home. But the minute I started selling security or representing a company that was selling security products, I felt like the tribe no longer trusted me as much as they did.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Great to be back on the air. Good to see you, Sunil and Mario. What do you guys have going on? Sunil, what have you been up to this week?
Just got back from the Gartner Conference. It's one of my favorites only because it happens to be in the D.C. area, and I'm in D.C. So, but it's actually a pretty good conference. It's like the RSA Junior, maybe, in some respects. It has the same sort of crowd with more senior people. But it's way more laid back and not so crazy like in San Francisco.
I've never been to that one, but I've always been kind of curious. You just gave some of the differences. So, but I mean, as far as like the people that are representing and all of that, you kind of said it was a little more senior or whatever. Is there a different feel to the vendors or the participants?
Yeah, well, the vendors actually find it, at least the ones I've talked to, they actually like that this conference better too, because you get the more time to speak with. It's less congested. It's Las Vegas versus Atlanta. Okay. In terms of, you know, just distractions, it's much more
subdued.
I'm plotting
a spectrum in my mind.
And I think even the vendors seem, I didn't have a booth or anything, but the vendors seem to, I talked to a couple of the founders, the CEOs, and they're like, yeah, I really like this conference because you have real meaningful conversations with practitioners here. So that, I think, was somewhat more interesting. It was just a data point that I collected from three vendors that I talked to, and three founders that I talked to, and they were pretty happy with the outcomes of this particular conference. But anyway, it does reflect also the nature of the folks who are coming. It's definitely very practitioner-oriented, just good event.
So one more question about before we move on. When I go to San Francisco every year for RSAC, I never go inside, and I'm not saying I never will or nobody else should or whatever. But I can get a whole lot of that conference on the periphery and everything going all around it. And it's walkable or scooterable all from Moscone in that case. Is that the same with Gartner?
Like, it's all in one facility. So it's much easier to move between the sessions and LobbyCon. And there is a strong LobbyCon for sure. But the ability to go back and forth is logistically much easier. So if you want to hit a session, and a lot of people hit the sessions, right? There's a lot of folks who actually go to the talks because that's kind of what they're there for. But at the same time, you know, if you get people who find themselves at LobbyCon, if you're like, oh, you know, I got to run to a session, well, you're only like 2 minutes away from walking over there and jumping in. Right. So it gives you the flexibility to do both.
Wow. So another reason not to go to San Francisco. Speaking of that, Mario, how are things these days in San Francisco?
Well, it's June, and we have a friend, all San Franciscans have a friend, his name is Carl. He likes to visit us during June, July, and August. That's our fog. So while the rest of the world, I'm sure Atlanta, I'm sure the East Coast is beautiful, but right now in San Francisco, it's 51 degrees. It's cold every morning. It's dark. Sun doesn't come out as much, and it's wet and cold.
Mark Twain, the coldest summer, my coldest winter was a summer in San Francisco.
Ah. Well, sorry to hear that, Mario. Well,
take your vitamin D's. Consume your vitamin D's. Take your vitamin D's. That's what we have to do in San Francisco.
You'll make it. Well, I'm sure that works out pretty well, so we have a pretty cool topic here today, and we're going to talk about, you know, as usual, about cybersecurity market and executive order and some gov-related changes and some technical glitches and a lot of the usual type topics that we talk about. But one we don't do as much is the classic Life After CISO, which is the original name of this podcast back when it was just me ranting into the wind three years ago. Where I used to just talk about, like, hey, what are you going to do next after being a CISO? So all three of us are in that boat, and we've chose the entrepreneurship path, And we were talking about what's that journey like. A lot of people have questions about that. A lot of people are kind of thinking about that or evaluating what's next. So I think that's a pretty good thing to talk about. So I think we should start that out by just kind of giving the background of it, because we're usually pretty cagey about what we do, and we don't want to overdo that. But I have a SaaS platform called Adversarial Risk Management, and it's cyber risk management as a service. You guys want to talk about what you do, just at an equal amount of detail?
I hate doing this. It's like, there's a part of me that's like, I really don't like being salesy, but yeah, I guess I have to. At least my co-founder will yell at me if I don't. So yeah, the startup that I founded is a company called Nostic with a K, and we help secure Copilot. So if you're trying to roll out tools like Microsoft Copilot and you're concerned about oversharing, then we solve that problem.
Cool.
Well, I think I'm going to be using both of your services soon in the new company we are launching. So I'm part of a founding team. We're coming out of stealth mode next month. But the name of the company is Whirl. So Whirl. Yes, we are doing AI, but no, it's not in security. That's all I can say for now. And cool. I'm excited. It's a great opportunity. And I'm definitely going to be knocking on both of your doors for either using your services for help and your advice. That's always useful.
Awesome. Oh, thanks. And congrats on that, Mario. I'm really excited about that. And interested to dig in like everybody else next month. But what we want to talk about was kind of that journey over, and you know, talk about. I get that question a pretty good bit of like, hey, well, you know, here's what I'm thinking about. How has it been, and all of that. I guess my reflection on it is, I think it was kind of easy for me to transition in some ways, in that I was always a very context switching type personality, a very DIY. So I always ran everything myself, and I would, you know, write my own policies. And I mean, here's a good example of it. I literally frosted my own glass wall in my office in an enterprise. Like, I bought the stuff and did it, like, ask for forgiveness later type of personality, and, you know, just, hey, we bought another company, I'll just fly to London and I'll find out whether that's approved when I submit the expense report, like. And that all work translates really well because of, I mean, talk about self-starter, right? You gotta, no one's gonna pick up the pieces for you if you're not doing it. There's a lot of other things that are super stressful and harder. But my thought immediately when someone asks is if I recommend it, is I feel like you got to be that kind of person or it's going to be really painful. Are you in the same boat, Sunil?
So let's also clarify, Jerry is a CEO, whereas I'm the CTO, or not in the same company, obviously different companies. But I think there is a substantial difference when you are the CEO, because there's a level of stress that never goes away. The company rides on your shoulders. And yeah, I'm a co-founder, but I don't feel that same level of stress as a CEO does. I feel like, you know, much to the chagrin of my co-founder, Gadi, there are days when I feel like I can, go to sleep and not worry about you know, tomorrow and all the things that are on fire, because I know that I have a CEO who does not sleep because of that. Right? And so there's a underlying level of stress that permeates one's life as a CEO, which is actually not very different in my view than the same kind of underlying stress that a CISO has as well. Okay. There are things that we, you know, that do keep us up at night, so to speak, as a CISO. And I have found that stress is about the same. I don't know. I mean, I'm not the CEO, but when I've been in that type of role or position, like, okay, I have that. The company rides on what I do, right? And so, anyway, that's just something to be mindful of. And so, those who are CISOs, I think what I'm saying is, if you jump into entrepreneurship, you might find it to actually be not much different from a stress level than what you're already facing today. Okay, but you just have more of a sense of control because, well, yeah, you can call the shots. You can go to London. You can do. And you kind of need to, because you're the only ones who are going to be able to pick up these pieces when things fall on the ground. And that's all. That is, again, the life of a CISO as well. So I think they match pretty well, in my view.
Mario, how's things?
You know, I think some things are. Some things change, obviously, and other things kind of remain the same. So how so? I agree with all of what you guys are saying. If you have that kind of, I'm going to go get things done, even if I work in a big company, I still want to, you know, I'm still going to do all this work because I enjoy it. Not that working in a big company doesn't mean that you do less work, but you do a lot of hands-on work as well. And so, you know, I was at a... I was obviously at Snowflake at a startup pretty early. I was employee number 50, went through the whole journey going public, exciting. But I enjoy small companies. I enjoy being part of the original team and helping out build that infrastructure, design the security from the ground up. I think that's really exciting. If you're able to learn from your lessons, learn from your friends, in this podcast, I learned a lot from all of you. Jerry, you've been really helpful pointing me out to some of things that some services out there for entrepreneurs. And Sunil always guiding me with ideas as well. So that's always helpful. I had a challenge, though, when I left Snowflake to go work at a security company. That's a startup as well. And it's a great product, ambit, great people, everything. I mean, it's really, please look them up. They're a great company. Great product. But I became a CISO for a security company for the first time in my career. And I thought it would be the same. Because, see, I met Jerry. People probably don't know the story. But I met Jerry because he was a prospect when he was at the ICE for Snowflake. And he wanted to ensure that the security of Snowflake was up to the smell test that he was asking us to be at. And so he asked to meet with me. And so I've always felt comfortable chatting with other CISOs, the security people, or other business leaders in our prospects to talk about the security program that we had at Snowflake. That's a lot different than saying, I'm going to sell you now a security product to the security people in the CISO. And I had a rude awakening. We can talk about it, Sunil. I'm sure you have a point of view on that, and Jerry. But here's a rude awakening. I'm part of the tribe, the security tribe, and I really, really enjoy my tribe, and that's where I feel at home. And but the minute I started selling security or representing a company that was selling security products, you know, I felt like the tribe no longer trusted me as much as they did. Because they saw me as somebody trying to sell them or pitch a product, which in essence, it's true, I was. Maybe not heavily pitching it, but still it was kind of an arm's length, and it was really dramatic. It was real. So any CISO who's going to think about going into a startup, you know, think about what that do to you. You know, Sunil and Jerry, I don't know if that was a similar thing that you've experienced.
Yeah, definitely. And I would say it... The hands link thing is more with organizations like Evanta or Gartner, or like the conferences, and the conference organizers no longer treat you as a practitioner. They treat you as a vendor. And as such, you have to pay your way in, despite the fact that, like, right beforehand, you were invited in. Anyway, it really depends on the organizers. And I found some organizers that are very welcoming to people who have been part of the community for a long time, because the reason why people go to those conferences or those events is because of other people, right? And they see the value that the individual brings rather than their affiliation. So I love those conference organizers, but you can't expect that for every conference organizer out there. And it does feel somewhat exclusionary when they say, nope, I'm not going to invite you to Miami for this really cool event because you're no longer a CISO, even though that was your community right before you switched over.
Yeah, you know, I remember there's a parallel to this too, where when I was deciding to leave, I had this kind of waterfall of people, when I leave my full-time CISO position, right? I had this waterfall of people that I let in on that, right? And it was kind of a you know, you start with your closest circle because you're still not sure yet, and you're just kind of like getting advice. And then there's some people where you're like, well, when I talk to this person, I better be committed because they have some obligation to spill the beans here, or they have loyalties to other people besides me. HR would be a great example of that, right? But shy of that, there was Tom Farley. He was the president of the New York Stock Exchange for many years, and he worked for us at ICE before that, and we installed him as the president after buying the New York Stock Exchange, and he's just phenomenal. And you can imagine that job and the people that you meet and so on. So I remember talking to him, but feeling like I can't ask this guy to keep this a secret. That wouldn't be fair. he still did, and he was great, but I couldn't have expected it at that point. And I said, you know, I feel like once I don't have that business card that says New York Stock Exchange and ICE on it, that, you know, no one's going to answer my calls. And he reassured me. He's like, you know, it's not as bad as you think. So I think a lot of that, and he was right. And a lot of that is just kind of like we're self-deprecating people, and we just kind of assume the worst, you know. But one thing he did say was that he did experience some of that himself. And what he would specifically say is, I realized that everybody doesn't laugh at my jokes anymore. It's kind of, he said, I used to be lighting the Christmas tree, you know, on Wall Street. He said, now everybody's laughing at my jokes as much anymore. And that's the Sunil's point where, yeah, you're not going to have the red carpet rolled out for you and get flown, you know, to be at something right away. But I think that's more on that commercial side, because they're constantly trying to monetize these assets with the vendors, and they're constantly worried about kind of people trying to sneak in. And that's what it looks like when we're now a vendor. But when it comes to the community and your tribe, Mario, and that, I found people were really good. And especially since, I mean, we are still a weird element, a weird unicorn element. We're not 23-year-old founders at a Y Combinator, right? We're totally different. And I do feel people give us a lot of time as long as we are self-deprecating and still on, like, hey, this is what we're doing. It may not be for you. And I know the problems with tools that you use today because I have the same problems, and here they are. And here's some that we specifically solve, and here's others that we don't. But commiserate, you know, and as long as you're still doing that, I find people say, like, okay, this is still one of us.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's like, exactly right. I think at the end of the day, for me at least, I've been trying to focus on, making sure that there's still content that people can consume, that people not just can consume, but can really benefit from in whatever program that they have, because it's from hard lessons that I've learned in trying to do this in whatever environment I might be in. And that's valuable regardless of where you are. And in some respects, this is where the whole field CISO role is starting to emerge. And I'm seeing a lot more of our peers moving into that role. And it's like, I think it's a nice shift from the high pressure environment where you're putting out fires constantly. And instead, I was with Renee Gutman just this afternoon, and you know, she's multi-time CISO at all these different places, and she's now telling me about how she loves just going to these dinners and yakking it up with people and visiting different cities. I mean, it's a nice, you know, it's a nice gig, and she deserves the rest, so to speak, this retirement, if you will. But at the same time, she's learning because she's talking to other practitioners and sharing what she's learning from other practitioners. And so they become effectively like a channel for sharing information across different groups as well.
I think there's three, one thing I would kind of focus on is, I think some of it is manufactured. I think Jerry's right. When I talked on one-on-ones with our CISO counterparts, when I was, you know, a CISO for a security company, they always talked to me. We always talked. We had good conversations, honest conversations, and so that was that. That's not what changed. I think the fabrication comes when you do attend these conferences, and it's clear in some cases that I don't know if it's the conference people or just the nature of it, but you become part of this side, and the buyer is on the other side. So they manufacture this kind of tension. Maybe it's a natural tension, it's expected, but it's not one that I was used to. You know, I didn't like that. I tell you another area that's manufacturers, the VCs. So here I'm an advisor to a bunch of VC companies. I'm also an investor in these VC funds. And I have one of those VCs, and well, the other one and a few other ones, but let's just say one of them called me and said, you know, we do this annual, biannual advisory meeting that we do, where you bring in CISOs to talk about what's hot, what's not, what you should be focusing on. And I was directly asked not to attend it anymore because I was no longer just a CISO, but a CISO working for a security company. And that was shocking to me because here I am, I'm actually investing in their funds. So I thought that was a very shocking thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man, that's tough. Well, I'll tell you, like talking about the field CISO thing that Sunil was talking about, I haven't done that. But when I think about it, one delta between that and being a founder yourself is that, like, you know, everybody says you always have a boss, and sometimes they're talking about like shareholders and if you have outside investors, and we're still bootstrapped, so we don't have that, you know, pressure yet. But the customers, I mean, the customers are the boss, right? I mean, more than anything. I mean, even when you had a, when you were at a company and you were working directly for somebody, you always at the end of the day were like, well, I can always quit, you know, or I could always say no and see what happens knowing I can quit. But with customers, it's like, you know, you're not going to tell them to get stuffed. Especially in the early days, every single one of them is so absolutely critical. So, but as a field CISO, in both cases, like when you're evangelizing for a cybersecurity product either way, whether you're a field CISO or founder of a cybersecurity company, and in both cases, you're winning people over and trying to convince them of the vision and whatnot. But when you're a founder, if the vision is lacking, it's on you. And generally, it's the answers to that are either, oh, no, you're thinking about it wrong. Let me try to convince you of why you don't really want what you think you want. Or, oh, yeah, you're right. We know we need to fix that. We're working on it. Or that would only benefit you. And look, you get it. We're commercially viable here. I need to build things that everybody will be able to use. So you can be pretty authentic about it. Either, yeah, it sucks, but don't worry, we're about to fix it. And if you're the field CISO, you could get into situations where you're getting bad feedback and you know something's not really great and you can't fix it. And that would be hard. Yeah. I know I've dealt with that with security vendors before where I'm just peppering them with questions and why is this like this and why is that like that? And you can just see when people kind of, the morale breaks and they're just like, yeah, I know. Yeah, oh, tell me about it. Yeah, I've heard that for the third time. And that's a dead end. Yeah. So I wouldn't
want to be a field CISO like that. On the other hand, I don't want to discourage people from CISOs from going and becoming entrepreneurs. I think Sunil said this multiple times. With the newer technologies that is available to us, you're not just building a new product. You can build companies, one person, two people. Companies that would take maybe 50, 70 employees. Now you can do it with a handful with the technology that's available. I mean, no bullpucky. I'm just blown away, not just by what one can do, but also this whole network of companies that facilitate even an HR company like, you know, Ripplings of the world, the Jessworks of the world. Think about what that would take to even 7 years ago to do everything they're doing and bring in up front. You can do so much things with a handful of people now with some of these services available that weren't around 7 years ago. It's incredible. I'm just overblown, excited, and fascinated. So please, I don't want to discourage anybody. Just be aware.
All right. Well, enough about that. Let's move on to politics. Now, we're not quite talking about politics, but there's a new executive order out, kind of remanding and editing and nixing some things out of a Biden-era executive order about cybersecurity. When I looked at the overview of this, like the table, I wasn't super excited, but Sunil, there were some things that caught your eye on here in particular?
Every president has the prerogative to shape the how the government is run in some respects, right? And so anyway, I'm not suggesting that the prerogative here is a bad thing per se, but there were some things that I thought were really valuable in the Biden executive order that I thought also had really broad bipartisan support that also has significant value for security itself. And that was the age verification or the digital identity a requirement that they put in. The age verification was also privacy preserving, or at least the proposed implementation would have been privacy preserving. But I think it would have also moved the needle significantly when it comes to just understanding identity, digital identity, or identity of like real people here in the United States. And again, it's not just the United States that's driving these sort of initiatives. You know, we're seeing this in other parts of the world too. But that is, I mean, identity is at the core of what we do in security. And if we could have had something like this, it starts the motion or starts the foundation for something that's better than what we know is already fully compromised, which is social security numbers or any other, you know, silly form of identity that isn't as properly locked down as we'd like. So anyway, that I was somewhat saddened that that provision got struck out. It's being pushed down to the states, but I don't necessarily see the states. There's not going to be. I think it's something that needs to really happen at the federal level. And I'm somewhat disappointed that that's not there. There are several other things that were put in that I think, you know, it's a matter of opinion in terms of how aggressively one wants to push certain types of regulation or relax regulations. You know, if you want to be very pro-business, which of course Republicans are generally going to be, pushing things to become less regulated is what you should expect. And that's what we see for the most part. I think there were a couple other things that that I thought were long-term, maybe detrimental for us. For example, there's I think it was around post-quantum crypto and relaxing some of the readiness for that the executive order that the prior executive order had as more of a firm mandates, but this one said, you know, we'll worry about it later, effectively. There's other things I think we have around crypto that we should do, like crypto agility as a stronger driver than just quantum, post-quantum. But that said, I think post-quantum is one of those cases where we don't really know when it's going to happen, but we know it's going to happen. So let's kind of at least be as prepared as we can, because when it does happen, things aren't going to be... You don't want to be in a situation where you're caught flat-footed.
You know, I think the... I'll second the age verification is very disappointing that they took that out. I was reading an article last week that a particular site company is going to exit France because the French government is mandating I wouldn't say robust, but just strong enough to verify the age of the user, because they want to make sure minors don't go to this website. And I just have to pause for a minute and say to all of you Americans out there, come on, America, we can do better than the French. Really, we should be doing better than the French. And so it's just disheartening. I think that's my call on this whole thing.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that we see as pattern is like the defederalization of things being used as a trash bin, if I can throw it out there, but it's kind of a marker for what's important. So there's, you know, you can kind of use the call of like states' rights to basically shelve things that you just don't really want to deal with a lot. On a related note, there's also like something the opposite of this that's going on right now, right? Which is a big call for to block the ability of states to regulate AI, right? That's a big movement right now. And I mean, like, I'm taking it at face value from the articles I'm reading, but what I'm reading is that that's an administration initiative that has objections from bipartisan objections to it, right? And it's hard to tell like when things are being moved in and forced to be federal like this, or forced to be done at the state level, which things are truly about efficiency, because regulation can be really ineffective and inefficient. And when I saw like the PQC requirements that were unwound in the executive order, like right now, if I remember right, the previous executive order was saying that basically products that are going to get bought by the government have to be quantum ready. And I could see that being a massive, silly you know, kind of like FedRAMP, and people are just jumping through hoops to do just about nothing. And I don't think that's the way you would solve that problem. So to me, that's an efficiency play that I totally get. And I think that's the idea here on the AI ban is, I mean, obviously the AI lobby is what's pushing for this, but the idea is if we have 50 or even 20 different regs around AI, it's going to be really hard to innovate and slow down the advancement of it. And that's the argument for moving this up. That said, you have, and funny, I think it's kind of ironic that Texas is one of the ones that was leading with AI regulation, and they're upset that it's going to get trumped by federal regulation in this case. That was a dinger. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the lens, so that we should look at this from a national security lens, because I think if you look at it from that standpoint, those two things actually align pretty well. So from the standpoint of the regulating AI, we are in an arms race with China, and there's a great power struggle here where the general perspective is whoever dominates in the space will dominate in many, many other fields as well. So if we choose to regulate, then are we hampering ourselves in that regard, right? That's a sort of obvious narrative there. But I think there's other, I think at the same time, we also recognize that we're dealing with very potentially dangerous substances, so to speak, or materials. And so we definitely have folks who are saying, look, we still got to do it with some basic precautions. I think for the most part, there are things that I think make a lot of sense. For example, revisiting our energy policy, making sure that we can have plentiful energy, not just for AI, but for a lot of other things, right? And having the right energy infrastructure to drive towards the next level of power needs that we have for the country as a whole, chips and all the things associated with chips, those are all things that we want to propel forward and not create more regulations around those sort of things, because that will hamper us in the long term. Going back to the national security lens, again, post-quantum or quantum being a potential concern, whether in building a quantum computer or once one is built, being ready to deal with the consequences of that. Again, there's a very clear national security interests here. I think it has been set back. I agree with you on the being, you know, having everything be PQC ready by end of this year versus being crypto, having crypto agility by the end of this year, which I think is a different type of problem, but is one that's actually solvable right now. I think in many ways hey, make sure you have IPv6 support by a certain time frame. Otherwise, no one is ever going to move towards IPv6. And, you know, I think government's still struggling to get there. It's going to be the same situation until it becomes a mandate. But when the mandate does come and we're like, we got to switch over to IPv6 or we got to switch over to this crypto, I think the crypto agility enables us to do that. And I wouldn't want to shortcut or short shrift that sort of drive to be more agile and being able to swap out our crypto whenever we need to.
Yeah, I think like if I could call them the move to go down to the states on some things, if I call that the balkanization of regulation. I agree, it gets in the way on some stuff. So today we're talking about AI regulation. Yesterday we're talking about privacy law, right? And I think the way you have to do it is to say, don't go and create your own laws, because we got one, right? And we got one. We're doing something federally here. So to do it in a vacuum and say, don't do anything, we'll let the feds do it. And by the way, we haven't done anything. That's a really tenuous spot. At the same time, I understand it's damn near impossible to get any legislation done, but certainly on something that is going to be, that kind of carries with it the weight of conflicting with states' rights. So it's hard to get a federal law in place first so that then you can point to it when you're blowing up the states. But maybe it can be done in concert, and maybe it's, you know, an EO that says, or it wouldn't be an EO in that case, but say states can't legislate around AI, for example, and we're going to have an EO that mandates the creation of a federal law, or we're going to at least incentivize it or somehow tie it to that. But all that said, like as a strategy, the idea of saying we're going to pave the way, whether it's in the interest of national security or your national commercial macroeconomic growth, to think about hampering the balkanization of regulation towards that. If we're going to be doing that, and we're going to do that now around AI, let's go back and do that for privacy now, right? I mean, let's while the iron's hot, let's fix that. I mean, why isn't that coming up? I would say there's a bigger lobby that would benefit from that than a lobby behind AI. And I know that's a big task because there's a lot of money in AI, but the privacy stuff would help everyone.
So here's my recommendation then. I'm listening to all of you. Here's my own recommendation, an exercise that I did. Go download the Big Beautiful Bill, BBB. It's over 1,100 pages long. Now, we have these wonderful new tools, new LLM tools that can really digest a lot of these documentation and summarize it. So get on your favorite, LLM tool. Make sure you type. Let's start a new chat so you clear all the noise behind it. And then say, upload the file, Big Beautiful Bill, and ask it to summarize it for you. And two, to provide a who's benefiting the most by this bill. And just do that exercise and see what happens. I'm just going to leave it like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're lobby-driven, 100%. You were right about that, and that was true in the past, too. But, I mean, to Sunil's point, leading in AI is, let's say, it's a strategic imperative. You know what? I think leading in commerce is a strategic imperative, too. And so, that's kind of justifying the retail lobby, too. And I think that's where something like privacy regs and lining that up on the state-by-state breakup could have a national interest angle to it that wouldn't be completely unjustified.
I mean, it's always happened, right? This has been going on since the beginning of our nation. But it's great that we have these tools now that are able to digest this information. Again, 1,100 pages is a lot of information.
All right. Enough about that. Let's get into the news here. So, I have a customer who is a couple that are Vanta customers, actually. And so I got a communication about this that they had a bug that exposed customers' data to other customers, and they proactively launched some communication about it. My take on this after digesting it and reading through it was that it seemed very maturely handled. It seemed like one of those things that inevitably happens. And I mean, that's at our startup, we're in the exact same space in this case. And that's the worst thing that could happen, the cross-pollution of data or cross-access of data to multiple tenants, that sort of thing. So the way they handled this, though, I was not triggered I think there's never a good reason to lampoon and just laugh at someone else, or it'll certainly happen to you after that. But I thought this was actually a really good way to just remind everyone that this could happen. It's real. Imagine it happened. Aren't we glad it's not us issuing this, and keep that as motivation, going forward? Did you guys get it wrapped up, or any reaction to that Vanta disclosure?
Yeah, so I thought it was interesting for a couple of reasons. But the main reason was the nature of the actual exposure. It's not in the core product, but rather in the integrations. And it was the integration. There was some misalignment, and I'm sure there was, I hope that they'll actually produce some interesting outputs on that one, but it was tied to some mismatch on the integration side, not on the core product, okay, if I read correctly. But that said, it's an interesting problem because more and more products that we have are dependent upon these types of integrations, okay? And I kind of noticed from just a back-end engineering end of things, but it's hard to create a it's hard when you are dealing with all these different integrations with all these different tools. It makes sense to use a single platform that does all that processing. It's creating separate instances of that on a per customer basis. Just creates a lot of inefficiencies. But anyway, but it also creates this potential commingling. You might want to create these logical controls, but it creates the opportunity for that commingling to happen. And unfortunately, that's what it seems like can happen here. So this points to, I think, a couple of other interesting options, which I would love to have, but at the same time may create other issues. So I'm going to point out to something that is Jerry's favorite, which is encryption. So I would love to have some mechanism that gives me, you know, customer brought keys or something like that, so that even if they screwed it up, I have a way to say, okay, within my customer tenure or instance, I have a way to ensure that my data, wherever it may be, whether it's this integration or that system or whatever, stays within my encryption boundary. As I mentioned, it's going to create other problems and other failure modes for sure. But I think this sort of this cross commingling through integrations is going to be something that has already happened, and customers probably haven't realized it. But I suspect that this will happen again in other ways too.
Did you know, as you're thinking about this, Sunil and Jerry, the commingling, Vanta has 10,000 plus customers, and apparently the ones who were impacted was just 4%. So have you guys, you know, I don't know if I read why that 4%, was it just the timing? Was it an integration like what Sunil's talking about, a particular integration? Mm-hmm. And that's what I don't want to poo-poo on people's mistakes. I just want to learn. Yeah. I wish people can actually explain it a little better, if vendors could do that better, so we can all learn for ourselves.
Yeah, my guess is it was because of only those who used a particular integration, and that particular integration got messed up in some particular way. I wonder if it's also a design issue on the company that you're integrating with. Could that have been done in a way that's simpler, or not simpler, but where the separation is done much more cleanly. So anyway, I don't know we don't know the details, but I think there's some interesting design patterns that we should learn about, that I hope we learn about, so that we can understand what anti-patterns to avoid as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we have to infer a lot, right, because we're looking at it from a distance. But I think, you know, people go down the BYOK route pretty quick. And I think that's like the wrong brush to paint a lot of things with. And then, you know, people get sold kind of a false bill of goods. And it's like end-to-end encryption. That's really what it is, right? So like first principle on that is BYOK. So bring your own key encryption, right? You're going to hook up to my service. You're going to hold the key. That means no one can read the data but you. That sounds great. That only works if it's a model where it's okay that nobody reads the data but you. And that sounds obvious, but... In other words, there can be no asynchronous processing of your data. Like if you're in Vanta. Right?
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as saying it's full end-to-end. It's a customer-managed key, and that customer-managed key can still be put into the Vanta environment to do the proper decrypt. But it is and so Vanta could still see it, right? I'm not saying that, so it's not full end-to-end, but it is something that helps create sort of like a two-key system, right, where you have to mess up multiple things for this to happen.
You know, you guys are bringing, again, another valid point. it wasn't Vanta data, per se. It wasn't like they were... what I understood it to be was more on... I almost felt like it was like a support system or support application that contained this information. What they had was whether the client was using MFA or not. So maybe it was their data. So maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I didn't think it was the actual data from the client, but mostly it was something more on the support angle. And I can see when you're using sort of a support application, how these things can go awry, because that support application contains multiple cases of multiple customers within that vendor's network.
Yeah, I get, you know, a little bit worried about when I hear encryption solutions right away, because then people spend a fortune and then 6 years later everything's still the same and people are kind of laughing to the bank. And I mean, like specifically, I think I know where your head was going, Sunil, is like you connect to Vanta and then you say, okay, Vanta, I want you to connect to my Tenable or something like that. And you've got to cut an API key out of Tenable and you put it into Vanta. And so in theory, there could be some, you know, full all the way, I wouldn't call it end-to-end, but end to closer to end encryption, where you would pull data that was illegible and then you'd have to put in the key there. And like, that's never going to get done right. I hate to sound so sour grapes, but like that, if you're a red teamer, that's just, you salivate over that, right? Because you got, or an adversary, you have time to figure out that encryption path. But as long as the platform needs to be able to unveil the data at some point without you there, then there's going to be a way. But you're going to spend a fortune in the process of it.
It has to read it in memory. And it's not like you're going to go use Nitro.
And then there's that.
Right? I mean, how many people are using Nitro today in AWS for that? I don't know. I don't know what that number is.
One other thing I would offer is, I'm not sure if any of our listeners here have used like an SSPM. So I have an SSPM that I'm using, and I've tried two.
Define that term if you're not going to otherwise.
SAS Security Posture Management.
Oh yeah.
Which by definition has tons of integrations to all these other SAS applications, right? Setting up these integrations is really painful. Actually, you have to jump through 1,000 hoops to it seems like 1,000 hoops for every SaaS application to hook them up properly, and there's a degree to which I say there's a lot of opportunities for mistakes or over permissioning, all these other sort of things, but I think at the same time the more complexity I'm not arguing for complexity too much here, but the more complexity there is, it's more likely it's because you're trying to create the right keys on both sides, so to speak, so that they that's talking exactly to who the other party is. Anyway, right now it's a very complicated process, and I hope that it becomes we move to the point where it's clearer and much more streamlined, because I think we'll see a lot of mistakes, but also we'll see again more opportunities for this sort of cross commingling to happen. Mm-hmm. By the people who are who are taking advantage of these integrations to deliver the services to you, and we end up with the kind of issue that Vanta has. The number of integrations is not going to stop; it's just only going to keep increasing.
Sorry.
So, I think this is we should expect to see more of these type of things in the future.
Yeah, my takeaway, like my quick blush at it, is I don't see any signs of them doing anything architecturally weak or wrong. I mean, I think we were just highlighting it's tough, and the integration service in a platform like Vanta has to be divorced from the user level service. So meaning it's kind of a god mode that then has to have some kind of identity management to fetch the key when it's doing a job for client A, use client A's key to service Z, fetch the data and reinsert it. And that same service is operating for multiple tenants and accessing different keys, and you have to get that right, and it's kind of the nature of the beast.
To unpack that a little bit further, for those who, and this is very specific, so many people who haven't ever implemented a SSPM may never experience this, but some of these integrations are done on a user level and not on the system level, not through a service account. I mean, the right way to do it is through a service account, because when someone leaves, the integration breaks, and that has a lot of other downstream business impacts. There was a minor little thing that we did where I switched admin accounts, email accounts from a normal. We created these elevated accounts, okay, and I downgraded.
Mario shaking his head. I think he already crapped on that whole thing, but a long time ago. But this is the East Coast, Mario. People still have service accounts, or still have SU accounts.
So we created these SU accounts, and then I downgraded my normal account. And when I downgraded my normal account, all these integrations broke.
Hell yeah!
And it's like, okay, well, is that the model that we want?
Well, I'll go so far as to say that, some of them require user context, right? It's like OAuth. You're basically logging in there through it. And every time that happens, it proves that there's no context-aware access. Like, that should not be possible. It should say, warning, Sunil, someone's got your credentials. They're trying to log in from this SSPM or whatever the hell it is. We're going to kill it. And nobody does. And we are so far away from context-aware authentication being ubiquitous. And it's an awful shame. So I think Vanta has handled this pretty well so far. It seems like not a thematic issue or structural issue, and yet they've been very forthcoming and public about it. And this is a private company too. So far, it seems like they're pretty upstanding. While we're on the outage and kind of bad marks topic here, SentinelOne, they had a service disruption. Anecdotally, I heard from my peers that some people were briefly impacted. It wasn't a CrowdStrike outage or anything like that. It wasn't a headline one. Delta's not going to be suing them. But what I did think was interesting was that it was linked to the number one cause of all issues at all modern companies, which is a deployment, right? Something goes wrong, first thing you say is, oh, is it cyber? And then you say, was there a release last night? Oh, yeah, there was. Okay, stop. We know what it is. It's probably the code. And
what, that's exactly stop what the happened. Press? It's not a cyber attack? Really?
Right. I mean, you have to deal with that every time. So in that regard, this thing is very similar to not just the CrowdStrike outage, which was software release, but therefore, shouldn't it be subject to all the mudslinging and the how dare they allow something to go in that wasn't perfect and negligence and all of that? It sounds like the exact same thing to me here, and I don't think that SentinelOne is sloppy and does a bad job here, but I do think it highlights that I think they overdid it when they were crapping on CrowdStrike.
I think the because of the CrowdStrike issue and because of how SentinelOne responded to it and taking advantage of it, you now have that much more additional scrutiny for any mistake that SentinelOne will have. And so I think even if this was a minimal event, it will get extra attention just because in relation to their handling of the CrowdStrike event, right? And I think this goes back to the earlier comment we made about Vanta. Look, we all make mistakes and we all do things that we regret. We're all fallible, right? And so giving grace to others goes a long way, because when you don't and you fall to the same troubles that others do, you want people's sympathy and not their you know, it happened to you too.
Yeah, it's a bad look. It's unprofessional, and you can't do it, and you certainly can't do it on a podcast that then has to take a break for a SentinelOne advertisement. You know, come on. Yeah. Well, and here we go. Karma's anyway, a bitch.
So to that end, I would say, you know, sorry, feel bad for SentinelOne. I hope they can get everything back up and running again, because it's a good product as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only thing I can think about SentinelOne is I have bought them as a publicly traded company. I bought them at, I think it was $35. I thought it was so cheap because they had come down from $70 at one point. And I got them at $35. Yes, I'm gonna make some money. And it went all the way down to $10. So I just don't have a lot of love for that company at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess some of our listeners have to ask, like, is this the cyber hit stock pick of the day? I haven't even looked at it. I'm assuming it hasn't gotten hit the way CrowdStrike did, and it's not going to have a knock-on of people that were stranded at the airport to all start driving stock price down. So I think the answer is no.
Well, for what it's worth, I've kept my CrowdStrike shares after the event, so I'm pretty happy with that.
Oh, I know. Me too. I can't wait for long term. All right. Other stuff that's going on. Yeah, everybody, people like us, and God, we've been doing this for a while now, but I think I on the podcast have talked about this in the past, about the SEC rule about notifications for cyber events. And that's the headline today is that banking groups have said, like, hey, the atmosphere seems pretty good to get that ripped out. Let's go back to Washington and see what we could do. So I don't know. Let me get one of your reactions to that change, too, before I weigh in on that.
Well, if I understand, the specific provision that the groups were trying to remove, well, one of the specific provisions is really around the timing. And I don't think it's not about not reporting. It's about like what are the mandate? I believe it's not about not reporting. It's about how is it if I don't report in this? If I report in this really narrow time frame,
48 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it really gonna the understanding of how material the event might be? Does it really move the needle? Does it undermine the investors in some way? And I think the data probably, I mean, we kind of see, actually, we just kind of talked about that just now in terms of SentinelOne and CrowdStrike, or even Vanta, Vanta's not a public company. But anyway, the point being, there's a lot of stories around, there's an initial hit, but then everything just bounces right back to where it was before. And it turns out it's really just a reaction to some of these things. And will we actually exacerbate that because of the being compelled to report things that maybe we're not really ready to report yet?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I wrote a comment letter on it, I think, about it before the SEC came out with it, and one of many people involved in that. But I wasn't the one saying, oh, we should legislate my personal career into prominence, right? Which I think a lot of people, that's kind of their default. It's like, what's good for me? And so everybody came out and said, like, oh, you must require a CISO on the board, right? I'm somewhat dramatizing it, but there were people that were like, oh, we're CISO, so we should just get that into the bill. Let's go. And guarantee us all board positions. And you know, if I were starving on the side of the street, that would have to be my strategy, but I'm not. So I was able to be a little more objective about it and say, like, as a shareholder of a public company, is that what's right? No, hell no. And I thought about all the CISOs I know, and imagine if they were on the boards. And no offense, CISOs, but we don't need to be running all these companies. So I wasn't so quick to do that. And I felt like where it came out was a pretty good middle ground. And the idea was just get some more transparency. You don't want to find out about it 3 years later. And mm-hmm. then, oh, yeah, we would have changed our investment thesis totally if we had known about this, and we didn't. So I thought it was pretty healthy. The 48-hour versus, I mean, there's never a right answer to how much time. And the fact that they said 48-hour from once it was concluded that it was material, I thought that was adequate. So it was okay. I won't lose a ton of sleep if that thing gets stricken. I don't know that it's a hill worth charging if you're bank execs. I remember when PR used to matter. And there's definitely should be some PR hit here. Kind of looks like people are trying to avoid being transparent. And I don't know it's really going to help financial services to get rid of this. I don't think it's hampering much.
Why did this come from the banking, by the way?
Is it organized and funded?
Is that what it is?
That's my take on it. I don't know.
So, Neil, you were, you know, at a big bank.
Yeah. Why? And so, Jerry as well, right? Well, you know, within the financial services. Well, mm-hmm. I think it's because we actually, we have a team that actually can observe these breaches and know when the breach has happened, because we actually have people watching
hoisted
these
by our own petard. Yeah,
right. So and many organizations just don't even have the visibility into it, so when they discover it, it's like, oh, ooh, you know. Anyway, point being, our ability to find more of these incidents is just increased because we have more people looking, right? And so I think what my conjecture would be, over the last 2 years, we've now have real data points of how much extra effort that this ruling has burdened the team, and based on that, is this something that is the juice worth the squeeze here, right? In the sense of, is it really providing real meaningful value? Can we extend it to a longer period so that it doesn't create the kind of stresses that we may be currently facing? That would be my guess, because these sort of things, we do, you know, there are many things that happen in any given in a security, you know, in a security team that is well resourced, you'll see a lot more. And being banks, still, you know, they are a target, right? Why do you rob a bank? It's 'cause that's where the money is, right? So I think in that regard, we may have more data points to be able to show that this is or isn't as effective as it was originally intended to be.
Yeah, and you know, knowing banking pretty well, I would also say that they probably have much more allergies to anything that has to happen fast because of their own bureaucracy. Like, in reality, this shouldn't be a problem. Like, if there's a materiality definition, I mean, if you've decided something's material, then you get 48 hours. That decision should be happening at a pretty high level with people that can get something done in 48 hours after making a call. And in reality, I bet they are hiring 20 more people. The second line of defense is questioning the first line, reviewing previous incidents now, and the audit, the third line is coming in and sampling incidents to see if a material. They probably turned this into a problem for themselves. So I'm sorry, stick with it. I don't think we should unwind it just to make that red tape go away.
Well, so any process improvements are warranted here. But I think one of the bigger challenges that came as a result of this specific ruling was also the word incidents versus breaches. I remember the whole conversation around this, around like, okay, now we have to figure out what an incident is, because before a breach was a legal event, and now we all of a sudden made incidents also a legal event, event as well. And so I remember the conversations being, okay, guess what? We no longer have, before it was we no longer have breaches, we have incidents. Now it was, okay, we no longer have incidents, we have events. Okay, so we're going to call them events now as opposed to incidents or breaches.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point being, there was a lowering of a threshold of reported, something that needed to be reported. And even though we may just throw it out as semantics, it did have the conversation that happened around like, what do we actually call these things?
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, I love the way that they treated it. This being the SEC, where they basically said a thing that a reasonable investor would find impactful and
material.
And that's it. I mean, you know, call it whatever the hell you want. If it would have moved the stock price, it triggers this. And I think that's reasonable. So, you know, I think the banks are being whiny here, but I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep if they unwind it. I guess that's my conclusion. There was a story that came out that, immediately it didn't pass my sniff test, but I'm not even going to say where it was, but it was cybersecurity teams generate an average of $36 million in business growth. This kind of stuff is just awful. It's trying to manipulate data to say that security is actually not only a cost center, but it's actually productive, and because of security, it's growing revenue. I just think, don't do this kind of stuff, people. Like, talk about selfish lobbying. Have you guys? Do you guys feel like that this kind of stuff is bad for the industry?
It's a story that we have around, we are a business enabler, all that kind of stuff, which mm-hmm. I think is a whole bunch of, BS to begin with, but that's it. I think, if the word said, cybersecurity teams, helped avoid $36 million in losses, yeah, that makes a lot more sense, right?
And it didn't.
yeah.
But generally, we're selling more oranges thanks to security. Yeah.
Wow, you guys are really jaded. Now, I would not, I wouldn't agree with the number that they put in there. But I do think there is a role, depending on the company you're working for, where outside of the company being a security product, so get that out mm-hmm. of the way.
Right.
But if you are going to be the custodian of some data on behalf of your client, I think it's important to say, or you're performing a service on behalf of your client that's critical to their infrastructure. I'm not talking utilities here. I'm just whatever that criticality is. I think being a good steward of that is important, and it might differentiate you if there are two products that are very similar, competing for the same space, the same customer, and one has a crappy security story and the other one doesn't. And maybe that's a way of differentiating the company. I'm not talking about, you know, selling potentially widgets here, but if you're, I think when I worked at Snowflake, security was a really important, it is a really important thing. And that did play a role, especially early on when the company's young. People wanted to understand, how do I trust this small company, this no-name company, this weird-name company, and how do I trust them with my data, the keys to my kingdom? And security did play a role. So yeah. I don't think it's the 36 whatever number, million dollars or billion numbers that they were talking about. I think you're right, Jerry. I think you're right, Sunil. But I think when you're trying to differentiate yourself from two very similar products, security can play a role.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you're right. And I think that people see that, right? And then and that's why Snowflake had a great security team. You're right. You wouldn't have got off the ground without that. But I don't think there's an unmet need of like awareness and the idea of trying to convince executives that they're going to make more money by investing more in security is kind of underhanded. But last thing, a little talk about the market. We kind of touched on a little bit about S1, joking about that. But a few articles out here. There's been some more raises. I still think at the big end that the market is pretty good right now for startups, for venture, for cybersecurity company valuations, let's say. But that said, there was a Wall Street Journal article out by James Rundle that mentioned that there's a lot of companies that are kind of waiting in the wings to go public, particularly around cybersecurity, and that they just haven't been able to to get out yet, and is that any reflection on cybersecurity to you guys, or is that just about the macroeconomic environment right now?
It's a combination of both, but I think there's also going public. The bar for going public has gotten higher. And there's a whole range of different reasons why that's happening. It's not just specifically for cybersecurity companies, but just the bar for going IPO has gotten higher. And that's why we see more acquisitions or more exits in different ways outside of IPO. It used to be for back in the early 2000s, I guess, you could actually see a company go, a startup go from where they are to IPO in a matter of 4 to 5 years, which kind of fit the time frame for like stock options and the 3-year the 4-year vests and all that kind of stuff. But now because IPOs have a higher bar, we're seeing companies. It just takes longer for a company to exit and to find a natural exit. Now there's, you know, outliers here, of course. There's other, you know, unicorns and such that do exceptionally well. But on a general point, it's harder for these companies to go public, just companies in general, because the market has a higher expectation for those public companies, as well as burdens that a public company has to do in terms of reporting. So it has to have a certain size to be able to warrant all the additional overhead for the expectations around reporting in a public for a public company. So anyway, point being, you have to be a bigger company to go public nowadays, and I think that's just a natural limiter for then cybersecurity companies, because cybersecurity companies generally don't get that big to begin with.
I agree with that. I would only add that, you know, we three look, not only do we work as startups, but we also invest in startups. Okay, so we see a lot of companies every day, maybe every quarter we invest in some of these companies, certainly. But it's not often that you see one security company doing something very unique, very different, solving a real different problem that it's not just a little feature, but it's a bigger problem. I'm going to, again, kudos to Jerry and Sunil. You're companies that I actually admire, and I see a lot of impact potential coming out of you guys. So here's my unfair pitch to my friends, because I really do believe in their products. But a lot of the stuff I'm seeing is just, there are just one feature, two feature company, security companies in a very small space. And how is that company ever going to go public? And so that's what I come think about. So I see a lot of new security companies, but there's nothing that huge. I mean, Wisp, Orca, I mean, yeah, you could see there's a lot of bigness there in solving a big problem, certainly. Yeah. But outside of that, I mean, what else?
So, well, I mean, you know, I think people are just stuck on revenue, and like another way to put what Sunil was saying earlier is I think companies were able to go public with, let's say, $100 million of recurring revenue 20 years ago, and now that bar is, you know, 500, let's say 300, 500, something like that. But to Mario's point, I think the investment community looks at a one trick pony with $250 million of revenue and says, I'm going to put my money on them anyway because I think they're going to diversify. They might even pivot. That they're good enough at this that they're going to move beyond this one trick and they're going to move on to it. So I think that's why you see things that I still consider to be very monolithic being viable or talked about. But when it comes to going public, there's a few. I think the capital markets are a lot more diversified. There's a lot more opportunities available to companies, right? You either go public because you want to raise money. I mean, that literally you do, but I mean, you need the cash. You're going to use that to invest in something, or for liquidity for the existing shareholders, which is really big, especially for these companies that are dragging around for 6 or 7 years, and you have all these people that are living off of promises and stock options, and you want to get them out. There's secondary markets now. Well, hell, Sierra did a raise. That's a recent headline, too. They did another massive raise, $540 million at a $6 billion valuation. I was pleased to see that somebody pointed out in one of my Slack groups that there was a secondary as part of that. It was like only $100 million. But I love that. I hope that was disproportionately allocated to some of the lower-level employees, get them some cash. So There's markets where people are trying to buy and sell secondary on the secondary market without going public. So that driver isn't quite as hot. And then on the funding side, you know, the secondary, well, not secondary market, but like venture and even private equity, there's a lot more funding sources. And you combine that with the macroeconomic turmoil in the markets just being very unpredictable right now. And I'm not super surprised. What I did see in this article, I'd read through it. It has a lot of cool quotes from people we know and love. And Island is in there, Mike Fay, and there's a few others. But Rubrik, the founder and CEO, Bipul, he has a really cool quote in there that caught my eye. And he's basically saying, among other things, that one of the allures of going public is for the PR. And I think people forget that. And working at the New York Stock Exchange, which was differentiated on the branding, like when you went public on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, you were going to be in the background at CNBC all day on the news. And you don't, you know, Sequoia does a great job of helping people promote, but it's not the same as that. And he pointed it out directly to say, like, here's why I still would care about that. And that's why we went public and people underestimate that. And I think that's very real. So at least that's still around. All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. It's always great getting together with you guys. Looking forward to the next one already. Best of luck with your ventures, and I hope to hear some more about that in the near future. And Mario, I hope you can get warm and survive out there in the freezing cold summer of San Francisco. And
I'm freaking and wearing a sweater in the summer, Jerry. A sweater.
Well, thanks, guys. See you next time.